Fred and Jeff and John are the three horsemen. They never get along, they're the three horsemen. They argue about science fiction and fantasy. Fred and Jeff and John are the three horsemen. Ride, horsemen, ride!
Greetings and welcome to the Three Horsemen podcast. I am, I suppose, the lead horseman tonight. My name is John Stevens, and I am here with my colleagues and two, not one, but two special guests. But let's start with my fellow horseman, Fred Kish.
Hi, good evening. It's Fred Kish. I can be found online on Twitter as @FredKish. Or my blog is Bernal Alpha, and that's about all I do, except I accidentally discovered I've been employed by the same company for 10 years, so I don't know how that happened.
Congratulations, I suppose.
Hey, I got a watch.
Excellent. And then there's our cohort, Jeff Patterson.
Hey, Jeff Patterson, JeffPatterson11 on Twitter. I blog at Gravity Lens. Actually, I don't. I haven't touched it in about 2 months because I've been busy with the various fires to put out and baggage to haul in my life. But I'll get to it eventually.
Okay. And then our first guest is Andrea Phillips.
Hello. My name is Andrea Phillips. I make things such as games and sometimes written work. I'm on Twitter.
As.
That was, I wasn't sure if this was a thing I was supposed to say. Yep. I'm on Twitter at @AndrHia, which is not really how you spell my name. It's a portmanteau of a nickname I used to have on IRC many, many years ago.
Oh, portmanteau, excellent word.
Thank you.
So you'll fit in fine here. Don't worry. Yeah.
I got drunk at portmanteau. What?
God. And can you tell us what the latest thing is you have made?
The latest thing that I have made is a novel called Revision that was out in May. I guess that's the latest thing I've released. It was very well received. It's about a wiki where your edits come true. And then in, I believe, February, I have a game coming out called The Daring Mermaid Expedition. Excuse me, The Daring Mermaid Expedition. It's a mouthful. And that's a Choice of Games game, and I think it's going to be super fun and very weird.
All right. That's great. And we also have guest number two, Jonah Sutton Morse.
Hi, I'm Jonah Sutton Morse. I host the Cabbages and Kings podcast, which I started earlier this year because I wanted something shorter in the science fiction and fantasy field and figured I would try making it. So cabbagesandkings.audio, all spelled out, or @KingCabbageCast is the Twitter account, and I am @JSuttonMorse on Twitter. And I spend the rest of the time chasing my two kids around and trying to find space to read among all of that.
Who was your latest guest on your podcast?
Oh, goodness. Parrish, PFunk1130. We talked about the first three volumes of Saga. He's PFunk1130 on Twitter. We talked about the first three volumes of Saga, which was really interesting for me because I really only read prose, and I was trying to read the words and the pictures kept getting in the way as I was reading
read
through
Saga. Saga so, as your first comic. Interesting.
Everybody, like, I kept saying, well, I should probably check out comics sometime, and people are like, well, Saga. And I said, so I finally bit the bullet and tried it out, and it was interesting and fascinating, and I don't know that I'm going to be picking up more comics.
Uh-oh.
No!
It's oh, just dear.
Not quite my... I feel like it's a different way of reading, and I would probably have to invest some time and energy into reading that way and learning to sort of appreciate and enjoy it and figuring out where I wanted to sit and what I liked, and there are other things I want to put time and energy into.
A comics heretic on this show.
I was about to say, he's the perfect audience for comics.
I'm listing in my head all of the comics that somebody should be reading if they haven't read comics before. But they're all web comics, so I'm not sure that properly counts either.
It's funny. I follow Schlock Mercenary. Like, mm-hmm. I discovered it, I don't even know, 8-10 years ago. And I follow that religiously. Like, I have the app. I get the 3 extra days ahead of time. So I read that, and I have read Saga. And I think I read Ms. Marvel as part of reading for Hugo Awards last year. But I just, in general, if I'm picking up a book, pictures confuse me. Which I see entirely as a failing of myself and not a failing of comics.
Well, not necessarily. No. Although there are plenty of failings in comics that can...
Exactly.
Enough to go around.
Plenty.
You should try Gunner Creek Court. Just you don't have to read the whole thing. Just try it.
Gunner Creek Court?
It's GUNNERKRIGG, Gunner Creek.
All right.
There you go. See?
All right.
I know Homestuck is not for beginners, so I won't even try.
I've had a few other people who, after hearing that I read them and wasn't all that compelled, have said, well, I'm going to convert you, so maybe mm-hmm. next year I'll try it out. Or try it out more.
Comic fans having that level of arrogance? Nonsense. That never happens.
It's only the greatest form ever.
No, wait, I will fight you, because the greatest form is games.
Oh, here we go. Uh-huh. I'm going to crack my knuckles and everything.
That was all I had.
Stay on target.
And our target for tonight is our favorite things of 2015. So not to be confused with a best of list, but the things that were your favorite. Whether they were good, schlocky, campy, you know, abstract, surreal, the stuff that was your favorite stuff, the stuff you really loved and you just got so much out of and you wish everyone else would read. That is our topic for tonight. Who would like to go first?
You, John.
I'll go.
Okay, I'll go.
Well, I'm not gonna pin down a particular book for starters, but two things that I did in my reading this year, which were incredibly rewarding, more so than I kind of expected them to be. Number one, listeners may remember at the beginning of the year, I went on a great big Pamela Sargent kick, starting with the Women of Wonder anthologies that she had done and then going on to her stories. That continued through most of the year, and every time I found something else that I had not read in a while, I went and reread it and was, I don't want to say pleasantly surprised, because I knew that I had really loved the bulk of that work when I had first read it, but kind of read it, and a couple other people had a similar opinion to what mine was, and that is the fact that she really should be a brighter star in quote-unquote the canon than she tends to be in a lot of various ways. And the fact that she did the anthology work that she did, the fact that she brought so many obscure women writers from the Golden Age moving forward to light in the anthologies that she did, and also the fact that her stories tend to be very, very compelling character stories, as well as having a sometimes grandiose sense of wonder. That was really the first reread strategy that I had for the year. And the second one sort of happened accidentally, and that was that I started revisiting a lot of the trippier space opera stuff from the late 90s. George Zebrowski, David Zindel, Linda Nagata, with some Brian Stableford in there as well. A little bit of the Hamilton stuff I went back and read. Some Jeffrey Carver, which is actually from before that. The very cosmic-centric, sprawling adventure that normally had larger cast of characters and did a bit of heavy speculation, a bit more of the fantasy end of science fiction when it came to interstellar cultures
ancient civilizations and big giant superstructures out in deep in space that have a mind of their own. This is a lot of the stuff that spurred, you know, people like Robert Reed and to an extent Robert Charles Wilson with some of the more theoretic tropes that they used in their stories. And going back and rereading them and stuff like S. Andrew Swan, just the big, sprawly space opera-y thing where stakes tend to get very, very heavy. And reading that and comparing it to like Ian Banks, who did similar stuff with The Culture, but at the same time sort of took, I don't want to say a more ironic approach, but certainly a much more lighter approach on the density of the narrative, by having a lot of modern vernacular and stuff like that being inserted as an artifact of translation, however it was that it was explained. Just seeing how pivotal that period in the late 90s was when it came to a lot of that flavor of science fiction, especially in having rolled out of the 70s and 80s, where science fiction sort of did a bit of a giant pendulum swing from the space-based stuff into the near future stuff and then back again. It was just fascinating. And once again, it's one of those little patches that tends to be forgotten, or it's remembered for the stuff that was really memorable, like Werner Vinge and stuff like that. There's a lot of really good material to dig through from that period. And it was just a lot of fun to go back and reread it.
Awesome. Anything else?
I had a couple of, I really liked, it was a couple comics that came out of left field that I really liked. We've talked a lot about Warren Ellis this year. And as much as I like the trees and stuff like that, the book of his that really turned me on the most this year was probably Injection, which took a very kind of if Torchwood was dealing with a AI version of the Lovecraft mythos. I really like that. There's been a couple. Gail Simone's Red Sonja stuff has just been out of the park all year, to the point where it's almost reached the level of Mike Mignola's Hellboy BPRD universe, where it's just a constant background noise of excellent material being pumped out month after month. It's very difficult to pick out one particular issue. And the thing that kind of surprised me the most this year out of everything, there was a book that Grant Morrison did called Nameless, which once again sort of gave a little bit of a side glance to the whole idea of an ancient unnameable mythos that exists out on the fringe of awareness. And he sort of tied that in with a clandestine space program and created this book that was visually stunning, where you had all this technology all marked up with protective icons, etc. And also sort of dug into, you know, cosmic horror, and stuck the landing too, which I was really impressed with. A lot of books that sort of deal with that. And I don't want to make this yet another year of Lovecraft, but I keep promising we are going to talk about Alan Morse's Providence when it finally wraps up sometime next year. I really hope this whole thing gets released on time, because the six issues that have come out so far have been a very unique experience in comic reading for me, because it's almost all exclusively dialogue, but that visual micromanagement that he does on a panel by panel basis is apparent in reading it on a tablet. I find myself zooming in into almost every single background just to see what the books on the shelves are and stuff like that. And of course, with that book, you know, going and reading the annotations online afterwards has been great. There was some really good Empire Rising by Mark Waid and Kitson was really good. Letter 44 continued to be really good. Paper Girls was nice. I was very surprised with that, and I want to know where it goes. Roche Limit Clandestiny was also a very good surprise and nice follow-up to the book from last year. Those are probably the things that turned me on the most. I sort of dropped out of my TV viewing over the last few months and didn't really do as many novels as I wanted to. However, when you mention favorite book, I've still got to hand it to Scarlet Gospels by Clive Barker, which I think really delivered on a promise that was very tough to deliver on, and he managed to do it. So That's about it for me.
All right, great. So let's choose one of our guests now. Let's go with Andrea.
How did I know? I knew you were going to pick me. The thing that I'm really super excited about right now is Supergirl, of all things. And it's been a long time coming to this point for me. Obviously, Supergirl was much anticipated, and there was a lot of concern that it would be a little too fluffy, and it would be easy to ignore, and it would be canceled after like 5 episodes. But what I found is it's exactly the show that I have been wanting for years now, because we have all of this darkness on television. There's this grimness, especially in all of the speculative fiction. There's very little lightheartedness. There's very little in the way of comedy. I mean, it's definitely golden age of television, right? And we have amazing shows with tremendous dramatic power and tremendous depth, but we've reached a point where we think the only things that are deep are the things that are scary or horrible.
I hear that.
Right? Right? They're just horrible, and they're not a mental space that I want to live in. So it's been so refreshing to have a show where the people really are good at heart, where there's narrative justice, where the sensibility is fundamentally one of hope and not of let me show you all the ways in which nihilism is the true way. I can't tell you how happy I am that this is a thing that exists. And then kind of on the same page as that, I read Karen Memory really early in the year. I think it was out in January. And it is still, I think, my favorite book of the year. And I don't say that lightly, because I have trouble picking favorite anythings ever. But Karen Memory was so perfect on a word-by-word level. And I'm kind of a snob in terms of prose. There are writers that do amazing word-by-word sentence-level work and also plot work. Max Gladstone, for example, does amazing sentence-level work. And then there are writers that are more workmanlike. Dan Brown, for example, is a very workmanlike writer, and that doesn't hurt his sales any. It's not a thing that most readers care about at all, but I care very deeply about words. And Karen Memory is just a perfect gem of a book. There is not a single wrong word from start to finish. The voice is so powerful that it just sort of pushes you completely through until the end of the book, and then you've had this lovely gem of an experience. I really, really cannot wait until the next one to come out, just to spend a little more time in that aesthetic. I have more things I loved, if you want to hear. I have a million things I loved this year. In terms of games, did you all play Her Story? Did any of you play Her Story?
No.
None of you?
Board game, video game?
It's a video game. It's a really short...
Sorry!
You
know what this show is? The Three Horsemen were the old guys? You
know? No. I will convert you. I'll convert you. Are you ready? Her Story is a video game that you play by typing in search keywords to get like 10, 15-second video clips of interviews with a particular witness, I guess, in connection with a murder. And it's several different interviews that happen over the course of a number of days or even weeks. And as you go through them, you progressively figure out what the story was, and you figure out more keywords to search for. And by the end of it, it's this amazing, sprawling, complex story that doesn't go anywhere that you thought it was going to go when you sat down thinking, I'm going to solve a murder today. The whole experience only takes about 2 hours, and it's not an expensive game. The production values are not high, but it doesn't need them. And in fact, a higher production value would actively work against the narrative that they're giving you. You should really play it. It's just charming and moody and wonderful.
All right. I'm downloading it now. You said it's videos, right?
It's videos. It's really short videos. It's amazing.
All right.
So you mean you're not running around shooting things?
You're not running around shooting things.
Because every time I've actually tried to play a video game, and I haven't in a while, but everyone's like, oh, it's this story about this happens and that happens, and I start the game and I'm running around shooting things. And I go, well, no, this isn't a story about that. It's a backstory about that. And the story is me running around shooting things.
I hear you. I hear you, my brother. And while I do play many a game such as that, this is not one of those games. I really hate Twitch games that require that you have some sort of level of physical skill in order to complete or win the game. This is not that game. All you need to be able to do is type search keywords. All right. Maybe take notes.
All right. John, you have another one for us? Go ahead.
I do want to insert at one point, I want to come back to what you said about narrative nihilism, because I do have an observation about that. So
sure.
All right. Do you want to give us one more and then we'll go back to Jeff?
Sure. If I had one more thing, it would be Envy of Angels by Matt Wallace. It's a novella. It's one of the Tor.com novella series that has just come out. And it is hilarious and wrong and so incredibly inventive. Basically, it's about a bunch of employees at a catering company that happens to work for a secret government agency, and their clientele is demons, in short. And I don't want to spoil anything because it's a novella, and if I say almost anything about it, it's going to spoil it. But it just keeps going and going and getting weirder as you go. Every page you turn, you think, okay, this has got to be the point where I know everything I'm going to need to know about how weird this is going to be, and now we're going to see the story play out. And it just keeps getting weirder until the last moment. So there you have it. Magnificent.
What was that called again?
Envy of Angels.
Yeah, the Tor novellas have been really great.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, short stories have been great, but they do an even better.
So what were you saying, Jeff, about
nihilism? My ears pricked up when she was talking about the I have not watched Supergirl. I haven't watched much lately, but the whole idea of everything having to, you know, wear its darkness on its sleeve and stuff like that. Even more egregiously. Oh, one thing I wanted to say was that if you didn't watch Sense8 from earlier this year, which was the Straczynski-Wachowski brothers miniseries, one of the things that I did like about it was that a good chunk of the story was these eight characters and their supporting characters actually having to figure out the situation that they're in. And the fact that they were all incredibly human and incredibly flawed, and a lot of them actually made you wince with some of their actions, while other ones were in situations that you're sitting there banging your head against the wall going, how are they going to get out of this? And I really like the fact that it never decided to go down even the truly dark characters never went totally down the hole. That's number one. Number two, the other thing, and this is something I blame Marvel for more than anything else, when you talk about this adherence to the darker narratives, is that not only do they have to, or do they feel compelled to do that, but it's done when 2/3 of the characters have to be smart alecks. John can tell you that back in the 70s and 80s, there were very few smart alecks in comic books. Spider-Man was the prototype for that, the superhero that makes jokes all the time. And now if you read an entire slate of Marvel comics, there has to be at least 2 smart alecks per character. And everybody's decided to go to the Josh Whedon school of witty comebacks, etc. And as they amp up this particular quality is when the whole wholesale destructiveness of all things, you know, is also ramped up at the exact same time. And now that it looks like we're going to end up with two Spider-Men in the Marvel Universe after Secret Wars, the whole situation just amplifies, you know. And I think it's, I don't want to say it's wrong or it's necessarily bad. It depends on the writer and it depends on everything else. But the leaping into the ultra grim, you know, while at the same time trying to use the trade dress of being lighthearted and having a sense of humor, I think is something that I really hope is going to evaporate at before too long. But I said that about zombies too, and they're still around.
Now, I would even say, if you don't mind, I would even say that this sort of snark that you're complaining about is a lot more widespread than Marvel. In fact, the voice that I write in a lot and that I wrote my novel in is, I call it Snark Modern in my head. And it's a channeling of essentially a very bloggy style of writing. It's what you find on Gawker. It's what you used to find on Wonkette, that sort of ironic detachment from everything. And that sort of way of looking at the world, that incredibly snarky, jaded perspective, I think hit all media in the 90s, and it never really receded. So earnestness is the new edgy, frankly, because we've spent, you know, 10, 15 years longer without any true vulnerability in our media.
I will agree with you completely. That what I'm blaming Marvel for is creating the template wherein, hi, we're taking characters that already exist and now they're going to be smartasses. You read Marvel Comics and Lord forbid, you know, you watch the movies and suddenly Thor and Iron Man and Captain America, and they're all making jokes, you know, and in the meantime, Hawkeye, who used to make jokes in the comic, isn't making all that many, you know, and you read the actual individual comics themselves and your traditional sources of humor, She-Hulk and Ben Grimm and Spider-Man are now almost lost in the background of everything else. But I do not want to get off topic. So this will be a discussion.
No, it's good. I'm glad to see we're riffing off of this stuff and talking about the subject matter as well as the individual works. That's great. Who's next? I see you back there, Jonah.
I have a long list. I will try to say short things about all of them. This was the year where I chased releases, new releases, much more than usual, which I am blaming Twitter for and which I am pulling back from next year. Because I felt
talking earlier about that.
When I read a short story collection, I expect to have a few things I really love and then a bunch that I kind of like and a few duds. And I feel like that was my novel for the year I was chasing the buzzy stuff. But there was some really wonderful stuff. So early in the year, I read Ian Sale's Apollo Quartet. Mm-hmm. And I loved the technique and the characterization. I felt like I learned a lot about kind of structure and craft as I was reading it. And it's four novellas, so they're all pretty short. Interesting premise, I guess, sort of near past alternate timeline about the early space program back when we were trying to get further and deeper into space rather than hold on to what we've got. So I really enjoyed that, although I did not read the appendices and have since gathered that I probably should have. And so I think I need to go back and reread more of it. I got to read Kate Elliott's Black Wolves early. I beta read it, and so it was really early in the year for me, and then I've had to watch all of these people talking about it and or talking about epic fantasy in general and being like, but Black Wolves, because I grew up with epic fantasy, and Black Wolves was like coming home. There have been a lot of epic fantasies I've enjoyed recently, but they've all been kind of variations and spins on the genre. So Jemisin's Inheritance trilogy a little while back kind of brought me into the genre. Ken Liu's Grace of Kings this year was another one of my favorites, and it was great, and it was big epic fantasy. But there was a lot of innovation there, both in the setting and the structure and the way he kind of wove in heroic episodes and had these beautiful cinematic fight scenes. And Kate Elliott's Black Wolves was like coming back to the genre that I loved, except all of the bad stuff and the fact that it was about angsty teenage boys with all of the privilege in the world, and that women are objectified, and that there's no economy behind it, and it's just a generic pseudo-medieval Europe. She just said, okay, I'm going to take all of that out, and I'm going to put in all of the good stuff and the wonderful stuff, and I'm going to have older protagonists and giant eagles. And there were just times over and over and over again when I realized she understands that genre much better than I did, and I kept having my eyes open and realizing all of the possibilities that are still left in epic fantasy if people can kind of take off some of the blinders and assumptions that the many, many, many Tolkien clones built up. So that was a wonderful read, and I loved it, and I get to go back to it after I finish a Crossroads trilogy. It's fine to read on its own, but it's also kind of a sequel to the Crossroads trilogy, so I'm looking forward to rereading it. That was great. I read N.K. Jemisin's The Fifth Season, which is mostly big secondary world epic fantasy, but maybe kind of science fiction, and it's really brutal, and it's kind of about the stories that we tell ourselves in order to do oppression and have families and how families work. And it was really, really good. And even having talked it over with a few different people, I still can't really wrap my head around it or describe it very well, but it was definitely one of the best books I read this year. That was awesome. I have mentioned Grace of Kings. Somewhere during the year, I went back and reread Kate Elliott's Jaren and remembered how much I loved that. Speaking of the Tor.com novellas, I read Kayashante Wilson's Sorcerer of the Wild Deep, which it's secondary world sword and sorcery. It's a tragedy. It's an adventure. It's a bunch of black guys being men together and code switching. And there's times where it's really in the vernacular, and there's times where there's this highly technical scientific language. He knows language incredibly well. He knows characterization incredibly well. I was captivated and pulled away. I liked The Buried Giant, and then I got to spend an hour and 45 minutes for the podcast talking with Maureen Speller about it. So brief plug, I ended up posting two episodes about it, and I really, really liked The Buried Giant and the experience about that, and thinking about collective memory and how collective memory works, and also how we remember things individually and within our relationships. So that was great. I learned while reading Uprooted that I have a tendency to read guys and read powerful wizards, and I actually had to put the book down a couple chapters in and start over again, realizing that it was the story of the girl who was brought to the wizard's tower. And once I did that and I could invest in her and what was going on with her story, it was wonderful, and I was enchanted and swept away. And I was thrilled that Ancillary Mercy closed out the Ratch trilogy really well. It was funny. So I liked that. And I think I will stop there.
All right. That is a cacophony of novels.
Yes, it is. And I apologize. But I had to mention them all, and it was great and wonderful.
It sounds like you actually had a really nice year reading.
Yeah,
I did. I felt like in the middle things got kind of slow, and I wish I was reading a little more, but putting books down I did not enjoy quite as much helped.
you hit on something there that when I talked about Gail Simone's work on Red Sonja, the whole selective recycling of the trope, that's probably the quality that I haven't been able to define. I think you just named it, and that's that she managed to take the scope and the savagery of the original Sonja stories, but added to them the dynamic of when somebody wielding a sword has to go from place to place and ends up having these horrible things happen to them. there's a reason that they're going there, and there's a dynamic that has to be engaged at some point. And the fact that Sonya in that story does everything she can to not get involved in these horrible adventures, and they find themselves inflicted on her anyway. And I think that your description of Black Wolves kind of brought that home to me. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
I've been having an interesting conversation with myself the last couple of years, and I don't know if it's the fashion in media to become more invested in the emotional situation and I guess the genuine emotional reactions of the characters as they go through whatever experience it is they're going through, or if it's just that I'm picking up on something that was always there. But I really feel like there's more play given these days to what it would actually really genuinely feel like to do these things in a way that, 10, 15, and 20 years ago, media didn't care about so much. Like, we didn't care about how difficult it would be to be a hero and the echoes of that through, you know, the rest of your life. And that matters in the stories that we have today.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That's I said that when the a couple friends of mine that didn't watch the relaunch of Galactica,
mm-hmm.
said, look, when we watched Galactica, when it first happened, we said, wow, this is a big adventure story with, you know, chicks in fur bikinis and stuff like that. And the relaunch happens. And the one thing that Moore did in there so well was gave you this constant background of, this would really suck if you were stuck on these ships.
Devastation, yeah.
This is a really bad, heavily dystopian situation, and it's an involuntary space adventure that these people are embarking on because they're trying to basically save their asses. And you know, you go back and you watch the original Galactica, and for as much as it tried to co-opt mythos to tell a outright space opera, nobody in that series was traumatized, wherein everybody in the relaunch was traumatized. And I think that speaks to what, you know, what's going on, is that as we see more and more of these stories occurring that are spun off by trauma or disaster or something along those lines. And like you said, go back even 10 years to a lot of the big, you know, epic disaster movies that were occurring then. It really does not get into the heads of the characters that are the most heavily affected by it.
Mm-hmm. Even if it does, it's on a very immediate reactive level. And there's no sense of implication.
Right.
I've been watching Deep Space Nine.
Did it do that back in the day?
No, the number of times that Miles O'Brien is severely traumatized, and then the next episode, everything is fine again.
Really?
There's an episode where he got, in his head, he got locked up in prison for 21 years.
Yes, I remember that.
And in like the last 8 minutes of the episode, that episode is about him sort of acknowledging the problem and the fact that he has to deal with it. But that's it. Right, like, after you've watched that episode, you would never know that had happened to him.
So he just shakes it off?
Between that week and the next week, he got all the counseling he needed, and that trauma simply vanished from his identity. Of course, then, 3 episodes later, you know, an alien being takes over his wife and holds her hostage and his daughter in order to make him do something. So, you know, I mean, he's periodically re-traumatized by all sorts of other things.
Well, I used to joke about the fact that between the Star Trek episodes Tapestry, Inner Light, and Best of Both Worlds, you know, Picard lives this whole other life. He basically dies and has this afterlife experience with Q and is taken over by the Borg. How is this guy still commanding a starship?
You know, because he went back to France and had a fight with his brother, and that made everything okay.
Precisely. That's it. It's like, okay, let's review the next starship captain. How many times has he been traumatized this year? 4 or 5. He's good. Let him go.
Yeah, and real military is if you hit your ship on a dock on the way out of the port, you get court-martialed, and that's it. You know, so
who do we need to be in charge of all of our first contacts? This guy. Yeah.
Why not?
Yes, nobody gets any psychological vetting when they're in charge of first contact. So. That was the there was that, who wrote it? And end of an age, end of an era, the two time travelers that go back to check out the dinosaurs. And we find out in page three that one of the time travelers is divorced, and that the other guy he's been sent back with is the guy his wife left him for. And I'm like, yes, that's right. These are the two guys we're going to send back in time, or these two. That makes sense. No problems here. There will be no emotion charged fist fights in the Pliocene age during this mission at all. We trust them. They're adults.
You know, one of the things I've really enjoyed about the Dragon Age series, and I apologize in advance because I talk about the Dragon Age series of games a lot. In the very first game, there's this guy, Cullen, who winds up being the sole survivor of a demon uprising in the Mage Circle where he works.
Like you do.
And then in the second game, there is a similar demon uprising in the Mage Circle, and everybody dies, and the city is destroyed, right? So he winds up finally being a major character in the third game, in Inquisition. And finally, in this game, you get to look into his emotional state a little bit. And he genuinely does talk about how angry he was and freaked out, and about how all of this left him with these deep emotional scars. And I tremendously respected the fact that they addressed that, what that would do to somebody, and how that would stay with you for a very long time. Mm.
Mm-hmm.
BioWare are such good writers. I wish even if you hated games, like, I kind of wish there were a version of these games that let you go through them as an interactive novel, making the narrative choices without having to do all of the fighting. Because even if you don't like doing all of the fighting mechanical parts of the game, the narrative that they have going really is tremendously powerful.
Can you just find all of that on YouTube? I feel like I've seen sort of the, like, here's a sequence of YouTube clips to see so-and-so's story tweeted out from time to time.
You sort of can, but you lose a sense of pacing, and you lose a sense of what your options were along the way. Okay. And unless you've played the game, it's really hard to know what to look at when.
Mm-hmm.
So mm-hmm. You can, for example, look at all of the romance options for whoever, I can't even think of a name right now. You can look at all of the romance options for Alistair, but none of that will tell you all of the sort of side quests that you've done and the offhanded comments he's made along the way that color everything that happens within the cutscenes. Mm. There really is a lot going on under the hood. There's a lot of incidental stuff. And then I personally feel, getting back to my Woohoo Games perfect art sort of firing shot back in the beginning, I really feel like being in the trenches with these characters and kind of feeling like they're your comrades in a difficult position winds up heightening your emotional reaction when you have these sort of pretend dialogue tree conversations with them, because it feels like there's something at stake in a way that a lot of dating simulation games, for example, wind up feeling very low stakes, because really all you have is they go on a date with you or they don't. There's no sense that you've been through some stuff together and that you have to continue working side by side to save the world regardless of whether you break up, right?
That's funny.
Maybe.
Sorry, I talk about games a lot.
This is actually stuff that I like to hear about, because you hear a lot about how great, you know, the gaming experience can be along with the stories that come with it. But that's a really good articulation of the exact process, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And I don't hear that very often in discussions about gaming, so that was really good, actually. It's, you know, it's about how the narrative gets generated by the particular media.
Mm-hmm. Well, so there's even a sense, if I may go on and on and on, I have a sense that there are entire emotional ranges you can tap in interactive media that you can't elsewhere. because no book in the world is going to make you feel complicit in a horror. Nothing that you read or watch on TV makes you feel responsible. And when you feel responsible, then the range of what happens to you and what your reaction is, it changes tremendously. Mm-hmm. All right. I'm done. We can get on with your regular.
No.
Chris, if you can go on now, I'm finished.
I'm sorry.
It's great.
No. Don't apologize.
No, that's our thing. We like to riff off of stuff that we're talking about like that.
The only tracks we stay on are the ones we fall off completely.
Oh, yeah.
So don't worry about it.
I did definitely notice as I was reading comics, there were things that a comic story could tell very easily and in just kind of the way the pictures worked, mm-hmm. that would have been very hard to express in prose. So I hear what you're saying about the, like, there are different media that are different, that can tell different kinds of stories.
Yeah, there are just different opportunities in the different media for structuring narrative, for expressing narrative, and for involving the observer / participant in the narrative itself.
It turns out side eye is really hard to do in prose.
What is?
Subtle side eye. It's really hard to do in prose, but very easy in comics.
we were talking about a while ago that was discussing the overuse of splash pages. You know, and so many comics will have the, you know, you turn the page for the page reveal and it's a splash of another character showing up who you weren't expecting, or it's a reveal of whatever the grand plan is. But too often lately, you know, in comics, you turn the page and it's, you know, the reveal of a character we know is there the whole time because he was on the cover. And it's like, well, that was a page that could have been six panels that were used to tell me a story. And the other gimmick that I do, and since I pointed this out, I keep seeing it more and more on TV shows, is the whole idea of the visual reveal in a TV show or a movie quite often will be prefaced by, you know, somebody contacts somebody via phone or via communicator and says, "We found something. What did you find? You better come see for yourself." Well, no one's going to actually do that in real life, but you have to do that so that the POV character goes through the door and is revealed the big scary thing that is supposed to be the narrative linchpin of the story. So, yeah, you end up with, when it comes to not only revealing information, but revealing reactions to information, you know.
Instead of just send me a picture on your phone.
Yeah, precisely. Yeah, why not do that? You know? Mm-hmm. The tool sets that are used in order to pull that stuff off and to show the reactions. You know, how many Steven Spielberg movies always have the zoom in of the person staring at the thing before he shows you what the thing is? You know, just to say, oh, this person is spellbound by what he's looking at, or confounded, or whatever.
So you know what? You've completely reminded me of something else I genuinely loved this year. And this is an embarrassing confession. Are you prepared?
We're ready.
Uh-oh.
I am the person that really liked Heroes Reborn. And the reason that I liked it, it's not even really, really because of the writing, although the writing was very strong compared to second and onward seasons of Heroes back in the day. I'm in love with the framing, the way that this show is shot. Because you watch it, and cut by cut, it is a comic book. And it's so exquisitely done to move from one comic frame to another seamlessly in video format that I almost don't care what the story is. But of course, the story has been really tightly written as well, so that works out for me. But I've been trying to encourage people to watch, even if you tried Heroes back in the day and you have bitter hatred in your heart for everything that happened after the writer's strike, please, I beg of you, go back and just try Heroes Reborn, because it's so beautiful, so expertly done.
Mm-hmm. No, that's a good point. I actually was watching Arrow for a couple seasons, but I stopped, partly because I realized that the way they shot a lot of it, there are two types of shooting in Arrow, basically. One is the action stuff. And the other is the non-action stuff. The non-action stuff is shot almost exactly like soap operas.
Oh, no.
People are placed in the room, how they actually stand, and how they converse with each other is very much like a soap opera. And I was just like, I can't take this anymore.
It's interesting that that would be a turnoff, because I know it's not the sort of thing that people tend to even notice. Mm-hmm. We take this stuff on such a subconscious level.
Right, right. But it was just, yeah, I just couldn't keep going. I was just like, it's not working for me.
For me, it's the use of a music cue because the actor can't act.
Right. Dun, 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 dun.
That's always the thing where I go, oh, good Lord. It's like every time, you know, Tom Cruise makes a movie, some composer's like, crap, I have to come up with his emotions for this film. So.
Nice. All right, Fred, is it you or me?
I can go.
You go.
Okay. Best of the year, mixture of print and video. On video, I mean, people know me know that I've been a longtime fan of Doctor Who going back to the 1960s. But the previous Doctor was getting kind of long in the tooth for me, even though he was so young. I just was, you know, it was like, okay, you know, whatever, another season. Even David Tennant at first was great, but eventually wore me out. But Peter Capaldi has rapidly become my favorite Doctor of all time. I mean, even in a pretty horrible episode like Kill the Moon, he has one scene. He always has one scene that just kills you. Like in that one, he does this whole, they ask him what's going to happen next or whatever, and he does this whole Olaf Stapledon riff on the future of humanity that was, you know, that just turned the episode around for me. So he's always got that. Or Listen, the open of the episode called Listen, where he's talking and, you know, writing on the chalkboard and stuff. You know, again, best part of that whole episode. So this season we had a number of interesting episodes, but the last two episodes were, for me, absolute stunners in terms of his range. We had one episode where he spent most of the time talking. You know, he's in the middle of a puzzle. I won't give anything away for those who haven't seen it. But he's in the middle of a puzzle, and he's talking, trying to figure it out. And it was just a one-man tour de force as far as, you know, the interacting basically against yourself. And the last episode of the season, he almost said nothing. So it was just his expressions and stuff that, you know, or him eating a bowl of soup, you know, things like that. Would just, you know, so for me, Peter Capaldi has been the best thing of the year on TV for me, just about. In terms of books, I'll just talk about a couple because, of course, I have read 8,000 this year. Not quite. But one that was absolutely stunning for me was, and I've mentioned it earlier this year, was Piers, P-E-I-E-R-S, Bizzoni, B-I-Z-O-N-Y, his massive making of Stanley Kubrick's 2001 A Space Odyssey. And there's two editions of this. One's a really expensive limited edition. And then there's this one. It's only $40. It's got like 90% of what was in the expensive edition and is worth picking up even if you have to skip lunches for. I mean, you open this book up and there are these pages that fold out two or three panels and you're left looking at pre-production artwork for the movie that you never knew existed or behind-the-scenes stuff. For the movie that you didn't know existed, etc. And, you know, background, notes, actors, special effects, how they did things, the people that gave him, you know, like Carl Sagan or whoever that fed into it, you know, Kubrick himself, Clark. It's just an amazing book. And maybe this will help Jonah in his quest for better comics, but I am I think volume 7 of my annual reread of The Sandman by Neil Gaiman and Company. So okay. I am, you know, once again, you know, this is kind of like Paul Weimer and Company on, I think it was Skiffy and Fanti, did a deep dive into Olaf Stapledon. So this is kind of like my annual deep dive into mythology and the mind of Neil Gaiman. And I'll probably end up reading a couple of nonfiction works out of, you know, based on this. But it's, you know, like I've read this, I think, every year for the past 5 years, maybe. And every time I reread it, I discover new stuff, notice new things. see how it hangs together a little bit better. You know, look, see how some things from the earliest issues tie in with later issues. So it's been very interesting. And there's like a couple of variants of this. I mean, you of course can buy them all individually. You can buy them digitally, individually or bundled. There's a 10-volume set, paperbacks. The two that I really like, I've got the omnibus that came out, I think it was 2 years ago now. But after seeing something else I'll mention in a little bit, I wish I had invested in the set called the Absolute Salmon, even though they're like $90 a volume. Just because seeing something bigger than it was published, some comics are really worth looking at when they're bigger. But going into a deep dive into this, the thing that I really like is the Sandman Omnibus, which is edited by Leslie Klinger, who's done so many other annotated volumes, such as Sherlock Holmes and Dracula and stuff. And he really goes into the background a lot. And the last book I'll mention is, and this is why I wish I had invested in the Absolute Sandman, is that Volume 1 of Absolute Trance Metropolitan came out, and I read it. And we have, as Jeff mentioned, discussed Warren Ellis many times in the past. And this is just, I mean, I read the book, the series digitally, and I had one trade paperback, which I wasn't really happy with because it was just so faded and it was not great paper. And I'm like, it doesn't look at all the way it was digitally. But this volume, the Absolute volume, I mean, they rework stuff. It's bigger than you got when you bought the thing in paper. It's even bigger than the trade paperback I bought. The color's stunning. The detail's stunning. You see so much more than in a smaller edition. So wonderful stuff. And of course, with this year's political cycle, it's even more scarily appropriate than ever was. So the last thing I'll mention, I mean, the one thing that Jeff and John have led me to do is to read a lot more comics over the years. And the thing that I really probably discovered the most of this year was Mike Mignola, you know, the Hellboy, the Bureau of Paranormal Research and Defense, and all his other series. I mean, you know, his artwork, I just love how much he does with the colors red and black.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, I didn't see, unfortunately, Crimson Peak because it came and went so fast, you know, the Del Toro movie. But seeing the trailer for that, I'm like, it looked like Hellboy on screen. I know Hellboy's been on screen and Del Toro did Hellboy on screen, but just seeing that was like, whoa, you know. And his artwork and his comics are always like that, you know, just black and red, and you're like, whoa, you know, how much you can get more than people that use 10 colors or 12 colors. You know, you can get just so more out of each panel. And I'll shut up now.
This has been a really good year for Hellboy too, given the fact that he's had three really good ones since the last one that was merely good. It's been really strong stuff this year.
Yep. All right, John. Now we get to hear you.
Bum, bum, bum. Well, I'm going to limit mine too because I realized when I was making up my list earlier in the week that I had about a dozen books on it and about a half dozen other things. That's a lot. So we're going to limit a little bit, but I'm probably going to write a blog post about it. But anyway, so one of the funny things about my list is that it also mostly covers my culture consumed.
Mm-hmm.
Because two of the things I want to mention are enormous collections. One is Lana Crone's Collected Fiction, which I literally just finished reading like 2 days ago, which is massive. It's all of her novels in one volume and all of her short stories in another volume. It's 800 pages at least. And spending that much time immersed in her story worlds is really indescribable. She's a very well regarded Finnish author, and a lot of her stuff, some of her stuff has been translated, but a lot of it hasn't. And this is a serious effort by the Vandermeers publishing concern to get her out in the world. And it's included with a big story bundle that's up right now, and I think until the first of the year. which you can name your own price on, which is good because it's got a lot of stuff in it. And the centerpiece of that are these two volumes of Crone's collected fiction. And I had never read her before I started reading this stuff. Although yesterday I was going through some books upstairs and I found I had a copy of one of her novels and didn't know it. But anyway, it's actually been a really good capstone to the year for me because it's, you know, it's like all the things I want out of my fiction. I want my fiction to be challenging. I want it to be really sort of high level literary performance. I want stuff in there that I'm going to have to think about for a while and take apart and ponder. And I'm going to want to have stuff that I just scratch my head at and realize I may not understand what that is, but I like it. And Crone's writing has all of that stuff together. And at the same time, there's a profundity to a lot of it you can't help but have a crew as you read the stories. So it's probably the closest thing I have to a favorite for the year is that collection. But I think part of that is I was so immersed in it while I was reading it that it's just sort of imprinted on my mind, and you know, it's rewiring my brain as we speak. And that was pretty fantastic. So not only do I highly recommend it, but it's definitely one of the favorite things I had this year. One of the funny things about the stuff I liked this year is that most of it is short story collections. Two more I'll mention quickly now. One is the Vandermeer's Sisters of the Revolution, the feminist speculative fiction anthology, which is a combination of, I think, reprints and new stories. And it is basically a history in short story anthology form of feminist thinking in speculative fiction. And it has beautiful stories in it. It has horrible stories in it, like stories that are terrible. Stories that not like they're bad stories. They're just stories that are heavy, definitely heavy, heavy stories. And it's a really nice mixture of approaches. There's like no one message that each story is telling. Each one has its own story. And it's really nice to see that sort of diversity of topic and approach in an anthology that's trying to do something, you know, feminist, talk about women and specifically focus on them. So it's really more of a roller coaster ride, I think, than the Crone, but that's good. I mean, it really takes you a lot of different places over the course of the anthology. And I appreciated that a lot. And I think the other one that I'll mention for now is, Letters to Tiptree, which isn't really fiction. It's a big bundle of essays edited by Alexander Pearson, Alyssa Krasnostein from Australia. And basically, it's exactly what the title says. It's a bunch of authors writing letters to Tiptree to tell Tiptree how much he means to them. And despite that, you know, seeming to be maybe not the stuff of great fiction, the really compelling thing about the book is that not only are all of these letters heartfelt, but they express so many different effects that people have garnered from Tiptree's writing over the years. And it's great to see that diversity coming from one writer and seeing so many people so profoundly impacted by one writer. It's easy nowadays to look out at the field of fiction, and there are so many writers and there's so much going on. You know, it's hard to see anyone kind of rising above sometimes. But so it's great to see that an author could have that profound effect on such a wide range of people. And there, some of the letters are beautifully written. Some are just really short and to the point. And like I said, what unites them is that not only do they appreciate Tiptree, but they tell you exactly what the meaning of Tiptree is for them. And I appreciate that a lot. And I think the last fiction I'll do for tonight is a book that I read before, but has come out recently in an American form, and that's Seb Dubinsky's The Song of Synth, which I think is his best novel. It's a story about a man who takes a drug that alters your reality and how he sort of goes from quote unquote normal to totally under the drug's influence and then sort of back again. And sort of about his journey through using the drug and how it affects his grip on reality. And it's written in very short, punchy chapters, and the prose is really spare at times. But you get the accumulative effect through the structure of the book itself, through the short, punchy chapters that are increasingly fragmented, through the fairly sparse prose that makes you fill in blanks and makes you sort of absorb what the character is going through in an indirect way that actually develops a certain amount of empathy for the character. So it's a really, on a certain level, a very rich book to read. But it's also very to the point, very focused, and very gut-wrenching in places. Even though I read it years ago or a few years ago and have reread it recently, that's possibly the best novel this year, although it's kind of in a tie with Liz Hand's Wilding Hall, which I guess is technically a novella, but whatever, which is a beautifully done novella. It's sort of a horror story, sort of a nostalgia trip, and definitely a meditation on making magic happen. And that was, like I said, it's kind of in a tie with Dubinsky's book as sort of the best thing I read this year as a standalone novel form. The only other thing I'll mention now is...
You're good.
That was weird, okay?
Maybe me.
Yeah, that was Fred.
It's Fred.
Sorry.
I didn't mention any movies because movies for me were a vast wasteland of boredom and tears this year. Except for Mad Max. Mad Max Fury Road was diverting. I don't think it was great, and it was confusing in many places. But what he did cinematically was just floored me. And really, for that reason alone, I found it to be, a lot of fun to watch. But I was going to mention a couple of comics, and Jeff already mentioned Red Sonja, and I never thought I would, come on a podcast or put it on writing. Red Sonja was one of the best comics I read this year, but Gail Simone does a really, really top shelf job writing comics.
Yeah,
I loved her Batgirl. Her Batgirl was stupendous. To the point where I'm disappointed in the new writer because they've shifted her in some ways that I feel undercut what Simone did with the character.
Yeah. Singing not the song, man. Singing not the song. It kills me every time.
Yeah. I mean, it was good that they went to a sort of lighter storyline, but it's so light and they've essentially made her a hipster in a very almost stereotypical way, which I don't like. It makes me appreciate Simone all the more. But this year, the comics that really kind of grabbed me were Red Sonja, also Simone's Secret Six, which is a perverse delight to read, I guess is the best way to put it. And then Rat Queens. Rat Queens is not, philosophically deep or making great pronouncements about the world, but it's just so much fun. And Curtis Weeb is so good with characters.
Mm.
It's just, I really never thought I would read a character-driven D&D adventure. But that's basically what it is. And it's just so much fun to read. And, both the main artists on it have been great. They're both very expressive artists. There's a lot of activity. There's a lot of feeling of energy in each panel, with a lot of detail, but not to the point that it distracts you hugely. It folds into the story. And going back to something Jonah was saying about earlier, for me, words and story just go hand in hand in comics. I like apprehend them both simultaneously, and that creates the narrative flow for me. So And I think this is one of the comics that actually does it the best. Mm. And then the final one, which I literally just finished reading, that was mentioned to Jeff a few days ago, is Brian K. Vaughan's Private Eye, which, you know, is kind of saga-ish, perhaps unavoidably so, in some ways, mostly in the aesthetic, but tells a really interesting sort of future noir story, but really gets under the skin of issues of privacy and identity and how we represent ourselves to the world. So that for me is a really cool combo. You can have fun with the noirish aspects, and you can really get into the identity questions and how characters act. I mean, it's set in a future world where everyone disguises themselves in public because everyone's paranoid about their privacy. And it's a story about finding out people's identities and figuring out, you know, how sort of how things have become the way they are. And I was really surprised that I got into it so deeply. But it's very well done. I mean, Vaughn's a really good writer. Mm. And when he's on the mark, he's really on the mark.
Yeah.
I think he really is with the Private Eye. And that's
the thing with Vaughn is, and this was true of Saga, and it's definitely true of Paper Girls, I have not read Private Eye yet, is that what is left out, what is unknown over the course of a story carries so much weight. Mm-hmm. When it comes to narrative, negative space, mm-hmm. the inexplicable happens, the a mystery or a circumstance or a condition takes on, you know, a ballast that you weren't expecting and you mm-hmm. don't know where it came from. He leverages all that so utterly well that he makes it look easy. There mm-hmm. there are pages in Paper Girls that where the inexplicable will happen, and part of it is unreliable narrator because they're obviously dealing with something happening through time here. But it's you stare at it going, how did he do that and I didn't notice? How did he pull that off and I didn't notice? And I really do want to read Private Eye because he become quite the master at that.
Yeah, I mean, and you know what makes Private Eye so compelling for me is right from the get-go, you don't know what you're not told what's going on. You're just there witnessing what's happening.
Right.
There's no info dump. There's no, as you know, Bob, in this yeah. society, we hide our identity.
Yeah.
There's none of that. Things just go. And you're like, wait a minute, there's a reporter pursuing this guy, but he's also a cop? Is that what's going on? Like you everything just gets undermined time and time again. And you spend a lot of time catching up. And oddly, that provides some of the narrative impetus of the story.
Yeah.
So I was really, yeah, I was like, wow, this is, you know, this is really good. I mean, Saga's pretty good, but this is really good. And yeah, just highly recommend it when it comes out. I mean, I guess it's been out in individual issues and it's being packaged. I just read the NetGalley preview of it. So when it comes out, I suggest people take a look at it.
Yes, I'm very psyched for that.
Yes. All right. Well, does anyone have anything to add about their lists or other people's lists? Or I think we've done a fair amount of talking about it.
I'm good.
So what we usually do now is what we call culture consumed, when we talk about stuff we've observed, read, whatever, since the last podcast. And actually, I'm going to go first because my list is pretty short. If that's all right. I've already mentioned one. Like, the Land of Kron was 800 pages plus. So that was a bit of a slog. That didn't leave me a lot of extra room. But I also managed to read Caitlin R. Kiernan's Beneath an Oil Dark Sea, her second volume of her stories, which is actually going to be on my sort of favorites list when I write it down later, because that was another fantastic collection. That, you know, both befuddled and challenged me, and that, like I said, that's a combination that I love. So I highly recommend, when that's available, grabbing a copy. And then, I also read Philip K. Dick, The Last Interview, which is from Melville House, and is, as the title says, some of his final interviews. And they're really good because they're, I think, some of his most thoughtful interviews. Because they're all, like, one of them was literally just a few days before he died. And there's a definite sense of him wanting to explain himself to the world. It's not like his diaries, basically, that were just all over the place. He's really specifically trying to zero in and explain to people why he does the things he does, what his thought processes are like, and how that affects his creativity. And that was really interesting to hear with a fair amount of clarity. So that was also quite good. And I'm about halfway through the year's Best Word Fiction Volume 2, and I'm really enjoying that. And I'm also reading Ursula K. Le Guin's latest poetry collection, which is called Late in the Day. And it's poems from about the last 5 years. And earlier in the year, I read her Finding My Elegy, which is a collection of sort of poems from previous years. And I had mixed feelings about it, really mixed feelings. But I'm finding more clarity in this collection than I did in that one. So, I mean, so far, so good. We'll see what I feel when I'm done with it. But that's also, like I said, a very interesting read. And then I'm also almost finished with Daniel Older's Shadow Shaper.
Oh, I loved it so much.
Oh, did you read it?
I did. I read Shadow Shaper and Akata Witch at about the same time.
Oh, wow.
On a business trip, actually. Mm. And they're an exquisite pair of books, it turns out, because they have a very similar sensibility.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, no, you're the one talking about Shadow Shaper. I just have to say, I adored that book.
I am liking it so far. I really liked Salsa Nocturna, the short story collection. And I'm finding some of the things I really liked about that in Shadow Shaper 2. And I think he can work equally well. Like, some authors, you sort of get a sense, are better in one, like, long form than short form, or vice versa. And he seems like a writer who can do both long and short form equally well, and he knows how to pace. And he also knows how to keep the narrative alive. There's no sense of slowing down necessarily, or, you know, of sideshows or whatever. It feels really coherent, but it's not, you don't feel it's driven necessarily. It's got a nice combination of sort of character and sort of time with the characters, and also advancing the story, which is a nice combination. So I'm looking forward to finishing it. I think I'll like it a lot. And that's pretty much my culture consumed. Oh, except that I started watching Interstellar and I couldn't finish it. Holy crap, that was boring.
I see. I haven't seen it. So this is the first bad thing I've ever heard about Interstellar.
Yeah,
I managed to finish it.
Did you finish it?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, what did you think?
I mean, attempts at sort of transcendent truths at the end of science fiction movies always go so very, very well.
Yes.
My wife kept saying, one more row, as she was knitting. And so we finished Interstellar that way.
I see.
That reminds me a little bit of my experience of Snowpiercer, which I think I watched early this year, and it had been so well received by my Twitter friends, basically. And then I wound up fast forwarding through ass sweeps of it because it was just so violent and I couldn't take it at all. And I mean, it was a fine movie, and I can see why people would like it if you like that sort of thing, but I guess it's just really not my sort of thing.
Gotcha. Well, Andrea,
mm-hmm.
do you have any culture consumed to report?
I have recently discovered Connie Willis, and don't laugh at me. I know Connie Willis, grandmaster of science fiction, right?
Yep.
I had been of the opinion that because she was a grandmaster of science fiction, this was going to be sort of staid, Clarkian and Asimovian sort of work. It would be perhaps a little dated, perhaps a little dense to work your way through. The sort of thing that you read for your betterment rather than because you enjoy it. Nobody ever told me Connie Willis is blisteringly funny.
Yep.
So I happened to read To Say Nothing of the Dog a little bit ago.
Oh, yeah. There's...
And it is such an incredible work. It's very textured. It has so much going on. Of course, it's very tightly plotted, as you do with any sort of time travel book. And then I have a perspective on Victoriana now from this book that's a lot more jaded, I guess, than it was before. I just can't tell you. It's very rare that you read a piece of fiction that changes how you look at something in the real world, but this really genuinely did. Mm-hmm. And then...
Have you read others in that series?
I have not.
Yeah, I would go get Doomsday Book because they're not all funny, but they all have that incredible same great sense of characterization and picture painting of the setting. And of course, Blackout All Clear was after that.
Of course, I'll have to.
But it's love those are the ones that are on my shelf, staring at me and saying, "So you're going to read us soon, right?"
Yeah, Doomsday Book was one of those books that I picked it up and said, "Okay, let's see what's going on here." And then after about 100 pages, I was like, "Yeah, I'm not putting this down until I finish."
It's a difficult thing. I think you've all mentioned falling into the trap of reading the new releases. And sometimes the new releases are great and you want to support a writer at the right moment in sort of the peak of their sales and help push people to be able to continue doing great work. But at the same time, there is also a tremendous backlist of really relevant, amazing works. And I've completely given up on rereading or rewatching anything ever as a way of splitting the difference. But, you know, I missed Connie Willis the first time around, and she's worth going back for. Mm-hmm. And then I'm reading a book about the design of the pencil right now called The Pencil, A History of Design and Circumstance. I'm a little dispirited with it, though, because I'm about 3 chapters in, and it spent a lot of time telling me how important it is to pay attention to the design process and the merits of everyday objects such as the pencil, but it's not been spending a lot of time telling me what those things are and how they came to pass, which is what I thought I was reading the book for. So it's a little more moralizing about the fact that I should read the book up front than I would prefer. Like, I'd really just like to get on with the information. If you know what I mean.
Yep. Sure.
And then I'm continuing to play tons of Dragon Age, like you do.
Gotcha.
For me, anyway.
That's what I've been told.
I'm sorry?
So I've been told that that's what people do.
It is. Spend time with my pretend imaginary video game boyfriend. That's what I do.
So how about you, Jeff?
I'm trying to think. What is it? Is it Bellwether? Is that the Connie Willis book about the monkeys, the chaos theory and the monkeys?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
It's so good.
Yeah, that's a great that's another one on mine.
With the sheep. That's the one with the
sheep. Yeah, the sheep. Yeah. That's really good. Yeah, but it's funny that you picked Say Nothing of the Dog because it's bracketed by two definitely not comedies. They have their moments.
But, no.
Yeah,
not
that was comedy. That was the lighthearted second act of
The Plague and the Blitz, not comedies,
yeah,
no.
Yeah. That's yeah. But it was kind of nice that she managed to pull such a great narrative spectrum with those books that I really liked. Okay, two things. Two books. I have not done much culture since last we did an episode. Two books I did read. I had heard a audio version of The Hole in the Hole by Terry Bisson on one of the fiction podcasts, and I don't remember which one it was.
But I found my copy of the collected stories of Wilson, Wu, and Irving, the three novellas that he wrote with those two characters, which is sort of absurdist mathematics. And I read that because I needed sort of an off-kilter character in my head for a while. I also found an ebook of the collected stories, or selected stories of Charles Beaumont. And there's a thing that they say. I'm getting an echo, just like Fred did before. Hold on. And now it seems to be gone. There's the old adage about reading short story collections that when you read them, you start to see patterns that the author does over and over again. And that was definitely true of the Beaumont collection, but at the same time, it didn't matter because the stories were so strong.
Is this the Penguin collection?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're definitely getting an echo here somewhere. Okay.
Yeah, I wonder if John put his headphones down.
Okay, well, it seems to be gone now, so.
Perfect.
I'll edit that out. So, let's back up and cover a couple different things here. Number one, Fred's love of Sandman and the reread of it, and John's anger at post-Gail Simone Batgirl. because they both come into play in what I'm about to talk about. I love Sandman. I read it when it first came out on a monthly basis. It was one of the first Vertigo books that really jumped the rails when it came to what DC was doing with their fantasy titles, their non-superhero titles. And while Sandman started off being firmly ensconced in the DC universe and dealing with some characters from it, it became its own thing. In a very big way. However, and I've said this before and I'll say it again, my favorite comic ever was the follow-up to that that Mike Carey did, which was Lucifer, which was the story of what happened to Lucifer after he had Morpheus take his wings off and effectively exiled himself to Earth. And it takes place in the same universe as the Sandman stories. It has a lot of the overlapping characters and a lot of the various motivations, but what made it stand out for me was the fact that it told an epic story about one creature's intent for what he wanted to do with existence, and it told this epic sweeping story through a series of smaller stories with secondary characters. And I probably reread the entire 75-issue run of Lucifer at least once a year because there's always stuff that I find in there that I didn't catch in previous reads. So, with the ads for the Lucifer TV series coming out, turning it into a cop procedural, I started to wince a lot. A lot. A whole lot. I had not winced this much in a while. Then I find out that they're bringing the comic back. And I was like, oh God, here we go. This is going to be rough. Well, the first issue of Lucifer came out this week. It was written by Holly Black with, what is his name? Garbett. What is it? It begins with an L. I forget the
author. Lee Garbett.
Yeah.
Right.
And I opened it expecting it to be another case of the singer, not the song, as John described with Batgirl. And let me back up a little bit, because there actually is, at the DC offices, after Warner Brothers posted their third quarter losses, one of the edicts that was brought down to the editors was no more taking established characters with their own arcs and their own personalities and rewriting them into something that's going to reach out to a wider, possibly underserved audience. And the phrase that was used was no more Batgirling, which has become a joke amongst comic fandom for stories where this happens. Mm-hmm. Anyways, I picked this up expecting to wince at every single page, and Holly Black delivered. She was in this. Everything was well crafted. Everything was well written. The only real returning character in it is Lucifer, although there are some angels, and they have the arrogance and the deep-seated fear that they have. And Lucifer reads exactly like Lucifer. And I'm not expecting her to pay homage to Mike Carey in every single page. But when it came to the dialogue and the way the story was staged and the way the plot was moved forward, and it's moved forward quite a bit in the course of this first issue, she is what I like to call a transparent writer, which a lot of times when you're dealing with established characters can be a very good thing in comics. And it used to be de rigueur up until, you know, the 90s when it was suddenly, oh, the author's more important than the character is. And a lot of times there are writers who will take a bad character or a misused character or a mediocre character like Warren Ellis doing Moon Knight and stuff like that and make it something unique. But very often someone will take a character that's fine as it is and say, you know what we need to do? We need to add more trauma to its backstory. and that irritates me. Holly Black picked up Mike Carey's Lucifer, made it her own, did a story that redeemed an ending that there really wasn't much coming back from at the end of Mike Carey's run, and has thrown a condition down into the world of angels and mythology that now has to be dealt with, and made it a perfect opportunity for Lucifer to be who he is. I mean, you look at the way that Lucifer was written by Gaiman in the Sandman comic, and then you look at the way that Carey developed him over those 75 issues, and it's just a spectacular character. So when you see that they're going to turn it into a cop show, you just want to bang your head against the wall to this blood. It really is frustrating. But anyways, I read that. I opened it with great fear in my heart and was not just relieved that it wasn't bad, but was very, very happy that it was good. And I will be a cheerleader of this until it goes wrong, if it goes wrong. But I don't think it will, because Holly Black's a great writer. She's got a really good track record. But you could have told me anybody was picking up Lucifer. You could have told me Gail Simone was picking up Lucifer, and I would have been nervous. It was just that unique and singular a storyline that really did not need revisiting at all. But the fact that there was a TV show based on, I just hope they don't decide to bring back new Preacher stories. We really don't need those.
No.
When that series comes out. So that's about it. That's my little lecture.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. All right. How about Jonah?
Sure. Two short stories recently. Podcastle did a reading of Sophia Samatar's Ogres of East Africa from Long Hidden. And I think that when I read it in Long Hidden year and a half ago, something like that, I wasn't quite... It is not sort of traditional plot-driven narrative, and I don't think I picked up on quite how subversive isn't quite right, but the way that it's playing with the colonial view of Africa and turning that around and stomping all over it. And it was read by Kalita and Troy Wiggins, and so the structure was easier for me to hear, I think. But I really enjoyed listening back to that yesterday as I was doing the dishes and getting the kitchen clean. I also read, on the strength of a review and post at Lady Business, I read Sunny Moraine's Eyes I Dare Not Meet in Dreams, which is a short story about fridged women getting up and out of their refrigerators. So lots and lots of dead girls appear all over the United States and are fairly uninterested in most people. It's not sort of a zombie uprising in which they go around eating people, but there is a great line about a whole crowd of them showing up outside of Joss Whedon's house. And they've been there for months and months and never left. So that was also a really, really clever story, but also just really, really powerful. And I enjoyed the prose a lot. I am reading Adam Roberts' Jack Glass. He's one of the authors that I've been following blog posts for quite a while, and finally said, you know, I should actually read some of his fiction. Max Gladstone is probably next on my list for that. But
oh gosh, you have to.
Yeah, on my list, and we actually have his first book on the Kindle, so soon. But Jack Glass is future science fiction, murder mystery. Again, very, very clever, very good writing. I'm underselling it a lot. I'd been kind of in a rut where I was having trouble actually sort of reading and finishing a book for the last month or two, and I am actually consistently reading it and really enjoying it. Mm-hmm. I'm watching Deep Space Nine. I am loving Deep Space Nine. I'm loving the fact that they said, we've got two whole quadrants of the galaxy, and what we really want to do with that is tell small domestic stories and put, you know, Quark's bar front and center, and that almost all of the characters, they pretty consistently kind of upend expectations. So I'm really liking DS9, and I just got...
Where are you? Hmm? How far into it are you?
I'm halfway, two-thirds of the way through season 3. I've been informed that 4 through 6 is where it gets really good. So I just watched the episode where they go back to the trouble with tribbles.
Oh yeah.
Which is of course hilarious, right? Like it is all fan service, but it's really hilarious. But yeah, I'm liking DS9 a lot. And I actually listened to the vast majority of the Hamilton soundtrack recently. I've been obsessed with it, and I don't feel like I need to introduce it to anybody.
Yeah. Who's
been
doing
that. I've been liking it a lot, but I also have two kids, and so sitting and listening for a while is not something I get to do. So, like, I know the first 6 songs really well, and I kind of had it on and was trying to make an effort to listen through the well. At this point, they both kind of enjoy it, and I realized how heartbreaking the second act is. Like, I've been thinking of Hamilton as this exciting and get you pumped up and really enjoyable, because I usually stop around Yorktown.
true story. I listened to Hamilton for the first time while I happened to be in New York City having meetings. So essentially, I listened to the second act while walking up through Times Square, weeping my eyes out. And, you know, getting concerned looks from strangers about what horrible thing had befallen me if I'd been dumped or something. But it was tremendous.
Yeah, it bears listening to closely, and it bears lots and lots of re-listening, which I have been doing a lot of. But yeah, Jack Glass is the book and a couple stories, and DS9, so, so good. That's my culture consumed.
All right. Fred.
John. Okay. Here we go. First off, the podcast that Paul Weimer was on that mentioned Olaf Stapledon in depth was not Skiffy and Fanti, but SFF Audio. That guy is just on too many podcasts. I can't keep track. Secondly, it's not much culture that I've consumed yet, but keep an eye out. I believe in January there's going to be an audiobook version of Dahlgren by Samuel R. Delaney, and I included in the show notes a clip to the narrator, Stephen Rudnicki, working on it, and I can't wait to see what the heck this sounds like.
Yeah.
Year-to-date books, 148. Year-to-date short works, 800. Culture consumed specifically. Well, tonight we watched Phantom Menace. It was my daughter's second time. It was my wife's first time. At the end of it, she turned to me and she said, "Oh, George, what have you done?" The Expanse, the first episode, Dulcinea, loved it. Can't wait to see more. Another TV show, Into the Borderlands, I think it is.
Into the Badlands?
Into the Badlands, yes. Great fight scenes, not much else that I really like, so I'm not sure if I'm going to continue. Already mentioned Sandman. Let's see. I think, unfortunately, most of the stuff I've already mentioned in the past episode, or past episodes, except I read the first of many Paul Anderson ebooks that have come out recently. In this case, The Makeshift Rocket, which is a kind of strange one, which involves, mostly famous for, it's a spaceship that's powered by beer. So, you know, it's worth it for that. XKCD Volume 0, Randall Munroe. A lot of classic stuff, worth rereading. He's always a wonderful guy. So I recommend that. And, you know, another CA Honorverse prequel written by David Weber, Timothy Zahn, who many probably know from the Star Wars Thrawn trilogy, and a guy named Tom Pope, who's a friend of mine. Bloom County, first volume of their digital library. And I think I may have mentioned this last month or the month before, Wayward Deluxe Volume 1. I reread that again, I think, since I mentioned it. That is a comic another one that I would recommend, especially, it's not quite as far out as Sandman, or Saga, I should say, but it's definitely caught the public interest.
Yeah, I just read the latest issue, and it's getting into that territory. So.
Yeah, it's, I mean, a lot of stuff on Japanese mythology and Japanese culture, great art, and young characters that I believe my daughters gotten interested in it because of that. I know a lot of other people with kids that they're reading it, so definitely something that I would recommend. And that is about it for me.
All right. That's a little shorter than usual for you, Fred.
lots of long work days. What can I say?
Understood.
And
one other thing I wanted to throw out there, I did. Right, I think the day after we did our last episode, I reread, once again, quite by accident, I reread City of Pearl by Karen Travis.
You just fell into it.
Yeah, I did. I just grabbed something on my way to go do something and ended up reading all of it. Fill in the blanks yourself. but I do love that book. So.
All right. Any final comments, anybody?
Well, you did ask for things we're looking forward to. Mm-hmm. I am definitely, after the first episode, looking forward to seeing The Expanse next year. Mm-hmm. I finally saw that there's news that Andy Weir, who wrote The Martian, is released a little tiny bit of plot detail on his second book. So I'll be interested in seeing that. Next year, I mean, every year I set up a plan of attack for reading.
Yeah, you were going to be all nonfiction this year, weren't you?
Yeah, that really worked out, didn't it?
Yeah, it did. Yeah. How'd that go?
But I did read a lot more nonfiction than I have in the past couple of years, but it didn't really work out, partially because of reading for this podcast, partially for reading for other podcasts. Yeah, so I think, in general, next year, I'm going to continue to try and work on nonfiction. And I really want to knock down some of these short story collections and magazines that are piling up.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the biggest thing for me, is that I just have so many anthologies. I'm like, oh, this is really great. And I start, and so I've read a story, put it down because the next one comes out. I mean, you know, I've said it before. Anybody who says they're bored these days is just so full of it.
Right.
There's just so much. So much.
Right.
People don't realize how lucky they are compared to, you know, when I had two drugstores with spinning wire racks where the books never changed for 6 months, for crying out loud, you know. So vaguely my plan.
You know, I'll see you and raise you. Anyone who knows me knows that I have had a real shitty year. A really, really shitty year. And I it got to the point where I would start reading a book and 10 pages into it would go, God damn it, I have things I have to do to put out fires and stuff like that. And so a lot of my reading tended to be somewhat tainted. So it was when I had these quote unquote accidental reads where I would just pick something up on a spur and start reading a chapter or go looking for a specific scene and find it and end up, you know, reading stuff all the way through. I got to the point where it, you know, having that bit of joy that kicked in sort of, you know, reminded me, you know, don't blame the science fiction for distracting you from the things that you need to do. And I also read a lot of nonfiction over the course of the year, primarily for research purposes and stuff like that. But quite a bit of it was also to read some dated nonfiction when it comes, you know, books on nonfiction, books on the meaning of culture that came out right after the end of World War II, and some books on counterculture and the impact of civilizations, you know, through from the 50s all the way through to the 70s and things like that I read. And it just sort of, you know, widened my vision, like Andrea said about reading Connie Willis, you know, putting new context to, you know, preconceived notions that one has about things. And I know Fred and John, I shared with you those, you know, Issues of Media scene that I got a hold of recently and rereading those from the pre-Star Wars 70s and seeing the columns that were written about what was going on in both SF fantasy and comics. And saying, yeah, a lot of things have changed, but my God, a lot of things have stayed exactly the same when it comes to the bitterness of fandom and the fickleness of readers when it comes to the way a lot of stories were told. And so I look at my ever growing pile, and I don't blame it as much anymore as I used to. So.
It can feel like a moral failing, can't it, to look at all of the things that you should have, you ought to have, and realize that you didn't, but there's just not enough time in the world.
Well, I actually have gotten past that a little bit. I mean, I certainly went through that a few times in my life. Pardon me. But a lot of it to me comes down to, you know, like Jonah said about, you know, saying, okay, ooh, look, here's this whole pile of books that's coming out. Well, I've gotten to the point where I look at that, you know, soon to be released thing, you know, with a jaundiced eye, you know, I'm saying, okay, well, I understand how publishing works, and Lord knows we've had enough authors and publishers and the like on this show that we have a better idea of how it plays out. But it's not so much that it feels like a moral failing, because that moral failing kind of implies a bit of obligation to it. And I really had to push myself past that. And I can clearly see why a lot of people do impact that. Just some of the comments that were made tonight about various books and video games and stuff like that. We all tend to be very parochial when it comes to our input. And the value judgments that we place on it. And once again, that's like, and I've said it before when it comes to, you know, doing this podcast with these two guys and getting me out of my comfort zone, the fact that it's made me not just a better reader, but it's gotten me to a point where I'm accepting of the fact that, yeah, I'm never going to get to everything. But it's not my job to get to everything. It's the job of everyone to get to everything. And the you know, the two conventions that I went to this year and going to the panels where they did a very good job of spreading out the backgrounds and the makeup of the panel, even when they were talking about Golden Age things and stuff like that, and looking at the various, trying to at least understand you know, differing views and alternate views on the way a lot of books and fiction and SF in general is perceived, you know, has been immensely helpful. So,
Excellent.
I always feel guilty right. when John hosts because I always dump this stuff on him, you know.
No, but that's I think that's a great thing to sort of to bring up at the end is thinking about, you know, where are we going to go now? It's like sort of, you know, what you're talking about is that, you know, the stuff you read this year has impelled you, you know, to think of other things and where you want to go with your reading. And, you know, I actually really empathize with what Andrea was saying about that sort of responsibility thing. Because this year I read a huge amount of brand new books. I got some for review, some were gifts, and, you know, some of them were just things that I really wanted to read. And at the same time, I'm looking at stacks of books in my to-be-read bookcase that they're sort of crying to be read out, too. It's like I want to reread a lot of Borges. There's other, you know, there's just a whole bunch of older stuff I want to get to, too. And I've definitely felt that sort of responsibility.
There's also
she was talking about.
There's also a sense I have that the conversation is definitely a moving river. And it very definitely is a conversation that we're having in genre fiction. And when you go back and read some of the Golden Age stuff now, it really is revisiting something that somebody said 3 hours ago at the party. And it's really not relevant to anything that's going on right now, even though it may have shaped the forces that got the conversation to the point that it is at the moment. So there's a sort of a dissonance, I find, where some of the things that were important in getting us here now just don't play the same way anymore.
Mm-hmm. I would agree with that. One of the things I found in revisiting a lot of the much older stuff is that while there's certainly an argument to be made about standards, and there's certainly an argument to be made about social norms in general, the fact that there are still some books in the quote unquote canon that went out of their way to kind of break ground in a not necessarily subversive, but definitely in a unexpected way. I mean, I still go back and think about, you know, Frederick Pohl's Gateway and how important that book was to me as a kid, having read as much Heinlein and stuff like that as I had when I was a real youngster. And that book comes out, and the whole idea of being out of control of your situation and being sort of enmeshed in this commercial and social system that is going to eventually kill somebody, and just waiting for that to happen was one of those things that really opened my eyes and brought it up. So if somebody was to turn around and start rewriting that book now, yes, it would be a completely and utterly different book. But at the same time, there are the individual narrative values that a lot of the books brought up. I occasionally see getting discounted more than they should. And a lot of that is because there is some grubbiness that you got to dig through in order to get to it.
It's not even that. I read War for the Oaks, I think, last year for the very first time. And this was arguably the book or in the wave of books that launched urban fantasy as we know it today, where it was sort of young and urban and punk in a way that hadn't happened before that. And I wound up reading War for the Oaks after hearing it was such an amazing book for so many years. And I was underwhelmed, and it was a failing not of the book itself or anything that it had done in that moment in the conversation, but so much water had flowed by.
Yeah.
And I was too old for the book for it to connect with me in that way. The things that it was saying were not new to me, and so it just hadn't been worth digging up. Not that it wasn't a superb work in its moment, but I wasn't in that place anymore.
Yeah, no, I hear you. It's like when the movie The Puppet, when the movie adaptation of The Puppet Masters came out, everybody said, hey, this rips off 7 other movies. And everybody was like, yeah, and they all ripped off the book The Puppet Masters. So
yeah.
it becomes a bit of a, you know, I mean, the same thing was said with, I haven't watched Childhood's End yet, but the same thing was said with, you know, how many movies have paid homage to Childhood's End?
you know, V and Independence Day and all that that have played with the whole idea of the giant ship inexplicably sitting over a city that's become the cover of so many books, you know, over the course of history. And that's one of the things I do think it's kind of interesting that we're seeing things like Childhood's End and Man in the High Castle being adapted now, you know, a generation, if not farther out from their, you know, original publishing date, and sort of taking them out of their context. You know, you probably couldn't do the same thing with, say, you know, to take those two authors, if you were to try to do something similar with, say, Imperial Earth or Valis. You know, it would be a completely, you know, different animal from what it was originally created to be, you know. But at the same, you know, at the same time, that's a whole other argument about authorial intent and the fact that a lot of these projects get picked up, quite frankly, to create content and make money, you know, and the fact that someone's at least trying to make the effort to relieve something of some of its baggage in order to get its message across is at least someone's making the effort, which is nice, because a lot of things I've seen lately where someone's trying to pick something up, they're clearly not making the effort. So, sorry, John.
No, that's great. I don't know why. Why is everyone apologizing to me?
I know.
We just had a really good conversation.
Oh. Yeah.
Yes, I feel bad that we had a good conversation. I admit to it all.
This is my thing now as I'm hosting a podcast and it ends and I'm like, I just got to talk to somebody really smart about something they're really passionate about and that we both enjoyed. And it's great. It's wonderful.
Yep.
Why didn't I start doing that sooner?
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's for me. That's the feeling that we had a good episode when we finally, you know, say goodbye and hang up. And I'm like, oh, yeah, that was totally worth it.
Well, I just got to make sure I post the right one up on the site. That's all.
Yeah.
I never did apologize to listeners for that last month. I'm sorry.
Yeah, well, you know, it happens.
I did have a moment. I already told the other two guys about this. Johnny, you'll get a kick out of this. I was talking to somebody at a small gathering and found out that they were a science fiction fan. And I said, oh, well, I've done some work with SF Signal and I co-host a podcast. And he picked up his phone and what's the podcast called? I go, The Three Horsemen, H-O-A. And that was all he typed into his phone was HOA, and he must have had an app open because as soon as he did that, the logo for this podcast came up, and my eyes kind of opened like, oh my God, I forgot how easy it is to download a podcast.
Yeah.
It's worth making sure that the code is entered correctly the first time, so.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
I still get a kick out of when I'm playing through, because I am subscribed to my own, and I still get a kick out of seeing the artwork, which was actually what finally got me to get around to I'd recorded a couple of episodes and I was sort of editing them and then I got stalled and then I got the art. I was like, I need to actually make this happen.
At World Fantasy in DC in 2014, when I met Sean Duke, he had done a panel about podcasting and there was this really young couple that ran up to him afterwards and started asking questions about, you know, what software do you use? What microphone do you use? And stuff like this. And he started chuckling and he said, you might want to ask Jeff that. And I said something to the effect of, look, I'm using a little Dynax microphone I got for $10 at Best Buy. And I'm using, you know, a free MP3 Skype recorder and I edit it on Cool Edit. You know, it's, you can ramp up as much as you want, but that should not be the obstacle that stops you from doing it, you know?
Exactly.
There's enough free resources out there to at least try your hand, and if you think you have a voice that needs to be uttered, then by all means get out there and
I'm sorry, that was just such a charming way to say that.
Yeah. If you must utter, you can.
Yeah. Well, no, but it's true. You get so many, I've had people who I talk to that will rant for 5 or 10 minutes on a subject and give me a very detailed analysis about why something sucks or something is good or something doesn't work or something isn't happening that should be happening. And I'll say, great, fine. Why are you telling me go write it down or do a podcast? And they're like, oh, I wouldn't know what to say. And you just want to, you just want to hit them. You know, you just want to start slapping people around, you know?
Well, they get in front of the microphone, then they freeze up.
Right, right.
It's hard to get past that.
Yeah.
Writing is really hard for me. I have started 4 or 5 blogs and never been able to really get, you know, do it enough to get comfortable with it. But sitting on a podcast is apparently very easy for me. So,
Have you ever been on Patrick's show?
No.
Oh, good Lord. Oh, you'll change your mind immediately after that.
No, you guys make you rocking.
Throw your arms up and go the hell with this than doing Patrick's show a couple times.
And now, having trashed our office, it's time to say goodnight.
We love you, Patrick.
Thank you. This was a great pleasure.
Oh, happy you came
this
on.
Was very lovely. Yeah, I'm really pleased.
It was fun. Thank you.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun. Thank you, Jonah and Andrea. And as always, Fred and Jeff. And I guess all that's left to say is happy holidays.
Yeah.
And we'll see you next year.
We'll see you next year. All right. Goodbye, everybody.
Good night.
Take care.
Bye.